I had nothing but positive relationships with the community. I found them to be, and probably some of the best witnesses I ever had.
Thies has no doubt that Miller would have killed again.
Yeah, he was vicious. I mean, you know, you see the results of his actions. I mean, it's horrible.
I think she told me at that point that he was gay and he had moved up to California. He opened up his own hair salon and that he had ended up dying.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. The word gender stalls UN climate talks. Vanuatu bans marriage equality and ponders a no-promo homo bill. And a serial killer is caught while a victim's queer legacy is found. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Ava Davis.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending November 23rd, 2024. Protections for women and the rights of queer people are among the stumbling blocks to finalizing a deal at the 29th Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. The Vatican is joining Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt at this week's COP29 in Baku, Azerbaijan, with objections to part of the 10-year-old UN action plan called the Lima Work Program on Gender. The word gender has suddenly become an issue. The initiative increases financial aid to women due to the environmental inequities they face. African and European Union representatives submitted new policy language this year declaring that women's experiences with climate change can differ depending on their gender, sex, age, and race. Delegates from the Vatican, Russia, and the three Middle East countries expressed concern that the word gender could be interpreted to include lesbians and transgender women. All five opponents of the proposed language update reject the very existence of transgender people and outlaw same-gender sex. UN reports conclude that by the year 2050, almost 240 million women and girls will become food insecure due to climate change. Just over half that many men and boys will face the same fate. Small-scale farms are routinely threatened by extreme weather and drought, and most of them are women-owned. The Lima Work Program on Gender is set to expire at the end of this year. COP29 was set to conclude on November 22nd, but negotiations over major disagreements regarding climate financing are expected to continue for days. Global anti-poverty group ActionAid's senior climate advisor, Zahra Hadidu, told the BBC during the week, "I think if things continue the way they are, it is not looking good for women's rights in the negotiations."
The Parliament of Vanuatu has passed an amendment to its Marriage Act that bans the legal recognition and registration of the civil marriage of a lesbian or gay couple. Marriage equality had not been specifically forbidden before, and the South Pacific Island nation has not criminalized same-gender sex since its independence from Britain and France in 1980. However, the Justice and Community Services Ministry announced in early November the formation of a committee to draft a Vanuatu version of a no-promo homo ban on public support for LGBTQ people. Pacific Sexual and Diversity Network CEO Isakeli Vulevo compared the government's actions to anti-queer backlashes in other parts of the world, telling Australian Broadcasting Corporation Radio, "This is also now happening here in the Pacific." Minister of Internal Affairs Andrew Napuat explained that marriage is already defined in the heavily Christian country's constitution as being between a male and a female, and that the amendment to the Marriage Act simply solidifies that restriction. The amended act threatens the revocation of a celebrant's license as well as the same-gender couple. The anti-queer crackdown comes at the behest of the president of Vanuatu's Council of Traditional Chiefs, who has frequently targeted the V Pride LGBTQ advocacy group, as a threat to the country's Christian beliefs and traditional values. The Pacific Sexual and Diversity Network's Vulevo told ABC Radio, it's really the country's queer people who, in his words, feel so threatened by these constant attacks from government parliamentarians and church groups, they have been too afraid to respond to these public attacks.
A ban on pediatric gender-affirming health care in the state of Indiana is going forward. This thanks to a 3-judge panel of the Chicago-based 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. They ruled 2-1 on November 13th that the ban did not restrict the constitutional rights of transgender children, their parents or guardians, or medical providers. Their decision to stand by their February ruling gives the state the green light to permanently enforce the law. Healthcare professionals are now forbidden from prescribing puberty blockers and hormone therapy to trans patients under the age of 18. The law ignores the recommendation of virtually every professional medical and mental health organization in the United States that such therapies are reversible and can often literally be life-saving. To far-right Republican Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita, denying that care is a huge win for Hoosiers that will help protect our most precious gift from God, our children. The American Civil Liberties Union and the ACLU of Indiana have been challenging the law. The groups say they are now weighing their options about a possible appeal.
Black gay actor Jussie Smollett's 2019 conviction for staging a racist and anti-queer hate crime attack on himself has been overturned by the Illinois Supreme Court. Smollett claimed that two men shouted racist and homophobic slurs, looped a makeshift noose around his neck, and beat him. However, the evidence showed that Smollett had paid Abimbola and Alobinjo Ashendaro to help him perpetuate the hoax. The brothers had been extras on Empire, the TV series that featured Smollett. Despite reaching a plea agreement, Smollett was tried by a special prosecutor. He was convicted in 2022 on 5 counts of disorderly conduct and sentenced to 3 months in jail, a fine of more than $130,000 in restitution, and 30 months of post-jail probation. He served 6 days of that sentence before he was released, pending appeal. The November 21st Illinois High Court ruling did not exonerate Smollett on the charges. It vacated the conviction on the technical due process grounds that the special prosecution should not have taken place. The justices wrote, "Today, we resolve a question about the state's responsibility to honor the agreements it makes with defendants. Specifically, we address whether a dismissal of a case allows the state to bring a second prosecution when the dismissal was entered as part of an agreement with the defendant and the defendant has performed his part of the bargain." Smollett's legal woes continue, however. The city of Chicago is seeking reimbursement in civil court for the resources it spent investigating and prosecuting the case. And the Ashendaro brothers are also suing Smollett and his legal team for damaging their reputations during the trial.
U.S. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson observed the Transgender Day of Remembrance by setting bathroom barriers for trans people on Capitol Hill. Johnson chose November 20th to announce the policy requiring members, staff, and visitors to use sex-segregated facilities based only on their birth certificate gender. Republican Representative Nancy Mace of South Carolina had already called for such a resolution and admitted to Sky News that she was specifically targeting incoming Delaware House member Sarah McBride, the first transgender person ever elected to Congress.
I want to make sure that no men are in women's private spaces, and it's not going to end here. This shouldn't be going on any federal property. If you're a school or an institution that gets government funding, this kind of thing should be banned. I think it's sick. It's twisted.
Is this effort in response to Congresswoman McBride coming to Congress?
Yes, and absolutely, and then some. I'm not going to stand for a man. If someone with a penis is in the women's locker room, that's not okay.
Mace could not actually know whether McBride still has a penis, and Johnson was vague about how the policy would be enforced. McBride herself has said that she will comply with the policy. She's been criticized by trans advocates for not fighting the ban, especially since staff and visitors don't have private bathrooms, unlike congressional members. McBride explained her position during an interview on MSNBC.
What are they talking about there on day one? Is where one member out of 435 is going, where she is going to use the bathroom? That is their focus? So this is not a great start. The American people say, mind your own business about where people do their business.
Delaware's Congressmember-elect, Sarah McBride.
Finally, stand-up comedian and comic actor Wanda Sykes gave ABC TV's late-night talk show host Jimmy Kimmel the obvious answer to the question, how are you doing, in the wake of the U.S. presidential election, but still had some encouraging words for virgin voters.
Jimmy, I'm a black woman and a lesbian. How the hell you think I'm doing? I met a lot of kids out on the lines at the polls, and the first-time voters, and I just want to say to y'all, so proud of you, and I told you that when I saw you, and please, don't give up on the system, all right? So just hang in there, and we're going to be all right.
Excellent. Wanda Sykes. Thank you, Wanda.
That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude for the week ending November 23rd, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Ava Davis. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
As they waited for a traffic signal to change so they could cross Santa Monica Boulevard, Aguirre looked to his right and saw a man crossing the street toward him. A familiar man. "That's him," he shouted to detectives.
It was him, all right, but the killer got away, twice. Frustrated with the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, a determined homicide detective engaged the gay community and went to the media to broaden his search for more witnesses and evidence. This Way Out's David Hunt clearly remembers covering the 1981 manhunt for the man who murdered four gay men and recently uncovered a contemporary coda to the story.
Take a step back in time with me. It's Friday, May 8th, 1981, a cloudless evening in Los Angeles, California. James Mack rides the bus to Hollywood to visit a few of the town's popular night spots. 11 o'clock finds him at Woody's Hyperion, a gay bar in the Silver Lake neighborhood east of Hollywood. Mack didn't know it when he started his bar crawl, but he would soon come face to face with a serial killer, a killer who targeted men he met at gay bars. Whether he would survive the encounter depended on a tenacious police detective and luck. I'm David Hunt. In this second part of a two-part feature, I revisit a story I first covered as a radio reporter in the early 1980s, a story that chronicles an unlikely alliance of cops and queers that work together to catch a killer. About 30 minutes after he arrived at Woody's Hyperion, James Mack struck up a conversation with a man standing at the bar, a man who introduced himself as Robert. "What brings you up to Los Angeles?" Mack inquired. "I was looking for you," the man flirted. Mack left the bar with Robert, and the two men drove around in Robert's sports car, ending up at a dark house with a long driveway in front. It turns out the men weren't alone. Robert, whose real name was Donald Miller, was the prime suspect in the murders of four gay men. Miller had been arrested for the crimes on February 27, 1981, during a stakeout of a gay bar, the Rusty Nail, in West Hollywood. But the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department, was forced to release Miller 4 days later, after the county district attorney's office decided there was insufficient evidence to prosecute him. The lead investigator on the case, homicide detective Mike Thies, wasn't ready to give up. He ordered that the suspect be placed under round-the-clock surveillance. After weeks of watching and waiting, that decision was about to pay off. As Detective Henry Cadena watched from a distance, Miller stopped in the driveway, turned, and struck Mack hard on the right cheek with his fist. Before Cadena could sprint up the driveway to stop the attack, Miller hit Mack again, this time in the mouth. Mack fell to the ground, bloodied, but alive. Within seconds, Donald Miller was back in custody. Now, Thies believed he had enough evidence to charge Miller with four counts of first-degree murder. Police had literally caught the suspect in the act of attacking a gay man he had picked up at a gay bar, the same bar where 22-year-old Danny Harmon was last seen alive in January 1981. But prosecutors in the DA's office told Thies he had a problem. His suspected metal pipe killer was caught beating a man with his fists. Where was the heavy metal pipe that would connect the assault on Mack with the murders of Danny Harmon, Robert Sanderson, Ernesto Ramirez, and Michael Thomas? Thies theorizes there was a simple explanation.
He forgot his pipe that night because the surveillance guys had a good visual on him. And when he gets out of the car, he's looking behind his seat, which is normally where he kept that pipe. But for some reason, he had forgotten it.
As it stood, the case was highly circumstantial. Prosecutors would have to rely on the testimony of just one key witness, Mario Aguirre, who saw his friend Ernesto Ramirez leave a gay bar on the night he was murdered in the company of Donald Miller. But because Aguirre had undergone hypnosis to enhance his memory of that night, prosecutors feared his testimony wouldn't be allowed by the courts. And so, for the second time in 10 weeks, the DA's office refused to charge Miller. The killer had escaped justice again, and, Thies was convinced, would kill again. In a bold move, Thies went public with his frustration and anger at the DA's foot-dragging, telling the Los Angeles Times, "In my mind, the case is solved." The Times headline trumpeted, "Prosecution lags in gay murders." Thies knew public pressure on the DA's office would only go so far. What he really needed was more evidence and additional witnesses. Once again, the detective turned to the gay community for help. With the assistance of volunteers from the Gay and Lesbian Community Services Center, Thies distributed more than 2,000 flyers to local gay bars. And he picked up the phone and called a reporter at The Advocate, a biweekly gay and lesbian news magazine.
You know, from talking to people, I knew The Advocate had a nationwide distribution, was highly read in the gay community, and it certainly proved quite useful.
In an article in The Advocate, Thies appealed to the gay community for help solving the case. He implored anyone who had survived a similar attack in Los Angeles to contact him. The gambit worked. The story in The Advocate yielded two new victims and, more importantly, potential witnesses. A third witness responded to a flyer he picked up at a gay bar in West Hollywood. Thanks to the cooperation of these gay men, all of whom had eerily familiar stories of being attacked by a man they later identified as Miller, Thies finally had enough evidence to bring the case to trial. You are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt. On Christmas Eve 1981, the DA's office charged Donald Miller with four counts of murder and three counts of attempted murder. An additional attempted murder charge was added later. But nothing about the case was ever easy. On March 11, 1982, the California Supreme Court handed down a controversial ruling that threatened to sideline the trial before it even got started. I reported on the development for Pacifica Radio.
Here in Los Angeles, the man police believe brutally murdered as many as five gay men may never even go on trial due to a legal technicality. In March, the California Supreme Court dealt a near deadly blow to the case against the suspect, Donald Miller, when it prohibited the use of any witness who has undergone hypnosis. The key witness against the accused steel pipe killer was placed under hypnosis a year ago to help him recall details about the suspect. Without his testimony, a conviction might be impossible, according to the district attorney's office.
In an interview shortly after the ruling, Deputy District Attorney Dino Fulgoni, the initial prosecutor on the case, shared his thoughts with me on the use of testimony aided by hypnosis.
My opinion as to the effect of hypnosis on a witness is that I'm opposed to people hypnotizing witnesses because I think it can affect their credibility. The problem with the Supreme Court decision is that it is a flat exclusion. All witnesses who have ever testified, who have ever been hypnotized, are prohibited from testifying regarding the subject of their hypnosis. There are cases, and I've cited some in a brief that I'm doing to try to get the Supreme Court to rehear. There are cases where there couldn't possibly have been any suggestion because the police had no idea at the time the hypnotism was done who the guy was. Where you can rule out this confabulation or making up of details by showing that after the hypnotism occurred, that the results of the hypnotism were confirmed by independent evidence.
Ultimately, the trial judge allowed prosecutors to put Mario Aguirre on the witness stand, even though he had undergone hypnosis to enhance his memory. Deputy District Attorney Steve Souders, who took over the case just weeks before trial, told jurors that Miller's history of violence spanned 20 years. The gay men who responded to the Advocate article testified about their experiences on the receiving end of Miller's rage, although it meant traveling to Los Angeles from out of town and sitting for hours in a crowded downtown courtroom. I reminded Thies that cops and queers didn't mix well in the 1980s. He shrugged off the suggestion. In his eyes, they were on the same side.
I had nothing but positive relationships with the community. I found them to be, and probably some of the best witnesses I ever had. You know, I'd tell them, okay, you got to be in court at 8:30. Well, they were there at 8 o'clock, never complained. No, they were just very, very responsible witnesses. No, I had no problems at all.
On October 13th, 1983, a jury of 6 men and 6 women found Donald Miller guilty of the murders of 4 gay men and the attempted murders of 4 others. They handed down the death penalty. In a final twist, the California Supreme Court took up Miller's appeal in 1990 and threw out Aguirre's testimony, ruling it was inadmissible. But they agreed that the testimony of the other witnesses was sufficient to justify the jury's guilty verdicts on all counts. Had Thies not worked with the gay community and the media to bolster the case, the guilty verdicts almost certainly would have been overturned on appeal. Thies has no doubt that Miller would have killed again.
No, he was vicious. I mean, you know, you see the results of his actions. I mean, that's horrible. Who knew what deep sociological issues created this monster that we saw that carried out all these crimes?
Donald Miller died of heart disease at San Quentin Prison in California on October 14, 2005, after 22 years and 1 day on death row. In 2016, 35 years after the killing spree, I told the story of the case on my blog, tellmedavid.com. I felt compelled to honor the memory of 4 gay men who had been senselessly and brutally killed in places they thought were safe by a man they thought they could trust. That's how I met Madeline Bransel, a policy manager at a research center in Boston. She spoke with me recently after visiting my blog and reading about Robert Sanderson, her grandmother's brother, one of the men killed by Miller in 1981.
I have one memory of sitting with my grandma at her kitchen table, and I must have been pretty young because I was trying to get a sense of like what her family was like and who her siblings were. And she told me then that she had had a brother who had passed away. And she said that he lived out in California. I think she told me at that point that he was gay. And he had moved out to California. He opened up his own hair salon, and that he had basically gotten kind of beat up at random one day when he was leaving his hair salon, and that he had ended up dying while he was out there.
Until she was an adult, that's all Bransel knew about her Uncle Bob. In 2015, the year same-sex marriage was legalized in the United States, Bransel fell in love with her partner, Alex. The couple traveled to Bransel's hometown to share the news with her extended family. The family's positive response made Bransel wonder if Sanderson had been supported and accepted when he came out in rural Wisconsin more than 50 years ago. And so she asked her grandmother to share what she knew of Sanderson's life before he moved to California.
I think she reflects on that period with like just so much empathy for him. It sounds like he didn't have a lot of close friends, or she doesn't remember a lot of close friends like coming around. And she hasn't given me specifics, but it sounds like he had a really rocky relationship with my grandma's dad, who is actually his adoptive dad. It sounds like their relationship was bad. I didn't get a sense of like if it was violent or what exactly that looked like, but my grandma said that it was really rough for him.
Bransel yearns to learn more about her uncle's life in Los Angeles and his experiences as a gay man in the 1970s and 80s. She wonders as well what her Uncle Bob would think of his young relative, a proud queer woman with a loving partner and a supportive community.
I've thought about what he would think of how easy my life is in my family, how easy my life is in society. I think live a pretty privileged existence, even for today. The things that he would have had to go through to just feel comfortable in his own skin and find his people is just something that I've never even had to imagine going through. And I hope that he would be very happy looking down on me and the experience I have as his gay niece, just kind of thriving and living my best life with a lot of ease, which I'm very fortunate for.
I'd like to thank Madeline Bransel and retired police detective Mike Thies for speaking with me for this feature. Special thanks to the One National Gay and Lesbian Archives at the University of Southern California. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Ava Davis and Michael Taylor Gray, and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was David Hunt. Simon and Garfunkel, James Blunt, Michael Witt, and Michael Shines performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Olson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Yavanna Foundation and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media. Email us at info@thiswayout.org or write us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078 USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening. Online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on KAOS Olympia, Washington, WXOJ Northampton, Massachusetts, BridgeRadioPA.com, Perth, Andover, New Brunswick, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.